they know I have for you.
Okay.
For the time, Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, there's minutes in the packet, December 19, March of 2007, March 5, 2008, April 9, 2008. Do you want a motion separately?
One will be fine.
I'd move approval of those three sets of minutes.
Four.
Excuse me.
April 8 as well.
And April 8 of 2008, I missed that. I'd move that the four sets of minutes be approved.
Any additions or corrections? All in favor of acceptance of the minutes as printed, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The minutes are adopted. Thank you. Representative Hoppe, House File 4151. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members and staff. I appreciate your patience with this and your allowing me to bring forward this pension issue for one of my constituents. My constituent is Britt Stroop, who's a teacher in the Wayzata School District, and she is not here today. She's busy instructing our children, the leaders of tomorrow. I will read you just a very short paragraph from the first email that she sent me. In short, I learned that my TRA was not contributed to while I was on an extended family leave to care for my first child in 2006. I just learned of this deficiency in February 2008 as I was applying for an extended mobility leave. Wayzata Public Schools originally approved my extended leave until we both learned of this deficiency to my TRA contribution in 2006. Currently, I am short 0.07 or 26.5 days of contribution and would like the opportunity to pay it back as soon as possible. And Madam Chair and members, she wants to pay that back so that she can get that leave for the coming school year. And it's my understanding that the Wayzata School Board would like to have this taken care of as soon as possible so they can go ahead and grant her the leave.
Like March 3rd or something, wasn't it? Mr. Thompson?
Yes, Madam Chair. Luther Thompson, representing TRA. Britt Stroop was notified on two occasions, but her name back then was Britt Hall, and I don't recall. So there could have been a mix-up in the mail or whatever, but she was on both a medical leave and a parental leave back in 2006. And I think the confusion arose here because while she was on the leave, she went back to work, so she was partly on leave and part working. So she was making contributions during that time. We have calculated the full actuarial cost in this case is one of those unusual ones because the full actuarial cost is less than the contributions and interest. So according to the statute, she'd be required to pay the contributions and interest of $823.77. The full actuarial value is only $545. Mr. Martin has proposed two amendments in his notes, and we would agree with 1A and 3A, but we don't think 2A is necessary. Since with this additional 26.5 days, she will have received full prior service for that period of leave.
So, Mr. Thompson, she doesn't have to purchase the whole time that she was absent then?
No. The school has verified the actual time she was absent was 26.5 days. But that was spread over the entire leave period. When she was on leave, she was actually working part-time at the school, and she was on leave part-time. So with the 26.5 days, the entire leave period is paid for and covered.
Okay. And so we want 1A? Amendment 1A?
Madam Chair, we do not object to 1A, and we also agree 3A is consistent with past policy.
Representative Kahn?
Madam Chairman, this is, I think, the smallest amount that has ever come before the Pension Commission in my memory, and in honor of that, I'll move 1A and 3A. I also don't understand how I've never seen the full actuarial cost less than the actual contributions, but I believe I'll believe that I'm doing what I've just been told to do. So.
I have another question, but let's move adoption of 1A and 3A. Is there any discussion? All in favor of adoption, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Now, Mr. Thompson, the reason she needs to pay this off really quick is so she can get the time served from that leave to count so she can take another leave. Now, what's going to happen at the end of that leave?
Well, it depends upon what kind of leave. I think we just got a statement in that for the next school year, she may be going on other leave. But until this bill is passed, she'll still have that shortage. I am hopeful that the omnibus pension bill will be passed before the end of this school year and before she goes on another leave. But we will address that issue, Madam Chair, when we get to it.
Okay. Is it her, Mr. Hoppe, do you know, is it her intention to come back to teaching?
Madam Chair and members, yes.
Okay. All right, any further discussion? All in favor of adoption of House File 4151 as amended, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you.
Madam Chair, that's adoption into the omnibus bill, right?
Into the omnibus
okay,
bill.
You.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I have to get back in my role.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Is Mr. Wally here? We have before us then, at this time, Ms. Stark? Oh, okay. He sent you here all by yourself, Ms. Stark?
Not quite.
Okay. Ms. Stark, can you give us a brief informational familiarization with the Duluth Police and Fire Amateurization Aid issues?
Chair Murphy and members, I would be happy to do that, and I appreciate the opportunity to address this commission. My name is Jeannie Stark. I'm the Director of Finance for the City of Duluth, and you're receiving a summary of the past history as it relates not only to Duluth but some other cities that have faced the same situation that we have for police and fire pension. Excuse me, I'm just trying to get my notes in order here so I know what I'm talking about. This is an issue that goes back, starting for Duluth, to about 1987. Prior to that, there were local police and fire relief associations. Each city or township had their own pension association. Starting in 1980, any new members had to join the Para Police and Fire Fund. So for a while, departments, police departments, fire departments had members in both. In 1987, the police department for the city of Duluth joined, consolidated with PARA. And this was an opportunity that was encouraged by the state, as I understand it, so that the state auditors wouldn't have to audit all of these independent relief associations. And members had a chance at that point in time to decide if they wanted to get benefits from their local relief association or through the consolidation account. And there were steps taken throughout these years for different cities and counties to actually approve that and for members to make independent choices. The Duluth Fire Department actually consolidated in 1993, I think it was. And what was happening in the time period where there were these consolidation accounts is based on each account which was held separately in the para police and fire fund. They were still being accounted for separately. They had their own actuarial studies, but they were being handled in one place. The actuarial liability was going up and down each year, and it was difficult for cities and townships to budget accordingly. One year it could be a couple million, and another year it could be a million, and there just wasn't a consistency. It appears from the files that in 1997 or 1998 that there was a movement afoot that was led, I think, from the League of Minnesota Cities standpoint, and I think the state probably was a partner in it, to get all of these separate consolidation accounts to merge into the police, para, and fire fund. And a number of cities had liabilities, and a number of cities had overfunding. So there were different situations for different cities. And there was an agreement made that the cities that were overfunded would have an opportunity to get some of their overfunding back. And I'm not as familiar with that because, unfortunately, Duluth wasn't overfunded, so I didn't bother paying much attention to that. Duluth, both police and fire were underfunded. We were one of about 20 cities that were underfunded. Our fire fund was significantly underfunded to the tune of about $20 million. When this agreement took effect in July 1st of 1999, all of the assets of all of the local consolidation accounts and relief accounts were turned over to PARA, Police and Fire Fund, and PARA, Police and Fire Fund accepted all future liabilities. In return for that, there was a 10-year payment period imposed on all of the cities that had underfunded liabilities, and the first payments were made in 2000, and the last payments will be made in 2009. Also as part of that, the state agreed to dedicate state aids to help the cities that have the funding shortfalls to help them pay towards these. And pretty much from 2000 until 2006, the city of Duluth and other entities, received, if not full funding, very close to full funding. It built up in the first couple of years, and then it was the full amount for several years. It dropped a little bit in 2006, and then in 2007, in October, I don't know what other cities faced, but Duluth was received $1.9 million total, less than what they had received the prior year, which was 50% of our obligation. Throughout the years, what has helped lead to some of the problems that we're facing is that there are a number of different aids that are dedicated to the cities, all cities, not just cities that have liabilities. The police and fire aids are based on how many staff are in each locality, city or county or whatever, or township, as well as certain other things based on police or fire, and I'm really not sure what they are. The net effect is, throughout the years, the benefits for the people who choose to retire have been enhanced. When this first took effect, members for police and fire got a service credit of 2.5% of their salary per year of service that they worked. That 2.5% has been increased to 3%. The early retirement penalty had been 4.6%. It has dropped to 1.2%. The net effect of this is that if you're a police or a fireman right now, it is very tempting to retire at age 50 when you have 20 years of service, because you get a fairly good-sized pension. And many people choose to do that, and then they go on to second careers. Another thing that's happened is there were certain state aids dedicated to this payment to help offset liabilities, and several years ago the legislature revoked one of the aids. It was a 0.65% surcharge on homeowners insurance, and it was replaced with a 0.5% fire surcharge, and that was dedicated to the state fire marshal account. So what has happened is, as the pension payments to members has gone up, the police and fire fund of para has gone from being an overfunded plan to an underfunded plan, and to react to that, the rates for para police and fire fund were increased starting in 2006 through 2009. Employers are paying 1.2% annually more each year. Members are paying 0.8% more each year. As the para rates go up, the aids to all of the cities and counties that have police and fire goes up. And so in Duluth's instance, we have maintained our staffing level, but our aids are going down because others are adding staff. So we're getting, what has happened is we've gotten sort of a triple whammy all at one time, which happened in 2007. It was a perfect storm. Police and fire aids went down because our staffing remained steady. There was the fire surcharge was redirected. That was cut. And then there just wasn't enough money because of the redirection to the para aid to go into these other aids, and that's what caused the problem. The unfortunate circumstance was that it happened in October. Budgets had been set over a year before. There's less than 2 months to react to it. We have made our payment in January of 2008. We have one more payment left, and we're just we're asking the state. We recognize your difficulties just as well as our difficulties, and we're just asking if you have any aids that you're going to dedicate for pension relief, that Duluth be allowed to share in that to help make up for some of the shortfall that we're sustaining. And that's pretty much 30 years in a nutshell as far as I know, but if you have any questions, I'd be happy to attempt to answer them.
Ms. Vanek, do you want to offer anything in addition?
Madam Chair and members, Mary Vanek, PERA. I think Ms. Stark did a pretty good analysis of what has occurred. We did caution folks in 1999, when we merged the consolidated plans into police and fire. We were very healthy at the time, and contributions were reduced well below the normal cost of the benefits of the police and fire fund. And so we did caution the cities that were involved in this and all employers that given the right economic environment and market conditions, that the surplus in the police and fire fund could go away just as readily as it had accumulated. And with a combination of the significant use of disability and the improvements in early retirement benefits and then the markets dropping, we did experience exactly that. And that was part of what drove the contribution increases. And also, I'd just like to comment, none of us in our discussions have gotten a good handle on the excess police state aid amount that could be available in the future. It looks like, because our contributions are paid by employers, and employers are then reimbursed by the Department of Revenue from this dedicated police aid that's collected as insurance premium aid. And as our contributions are going up, the amount then that revenue reimburses to local government for our police pension costs is increasing. And so the money available to be redistributed to help these cities like Duluth pay off that fixed payment has declined. And so it has been another contributing factor to the perfect storm, as she described it.
Thank you.
Chair Murphy, I would like to just make one more comment. Duluth does appreciate everything that the state has done for us. The state has given us a significant amount of money over the years to help us with this. The city of Duluth, in turn, has been paying their payments on a timely basis, and at the end of the 10 years, we will have not only paid off our liability, which was $26.1 million, but we will have paid another $12.1 million to the state in interest payments for that. So we have been paying a fairly healthy chunk of money for this privilege. We have also been experiencing budgetary problems. We have recognized the importance of public safety, and we have maintained our police and fire funds to the expense of 200 other employees in the city of Duluth. We have cut our employment force from 1,000 to 800 to maintain police and fire. So we're trying to do our part to keep our citizens safe, and we just would appreciate any help that the state could give us financially with this.
Thank you, Ms. Stark. Thank you, Ms. Vanek. One correction, Representative Smith. You carried the bill on the money for the fire marshal. And if I remember correctly, and I was second author, I believe, I don't think that money affects the situation Ms. Stark is talking about.
Madam Chair, offhand, that's a correct statement, I think.
I don't believe that the money that went to the fire marshal came out of any money that you were getting.
We were told by the Department of Finance, the State Department of Finance, that there was a 0.5% surcharge on insurance companies, and that was done away with. And that money was coming to the cities that had the liabilities, and it was replaced with a 0.65% surcharge on homeowners, not on insurance companies, and it was the homeowners surcharge that was given to the state fire marshal account.
Did you have that in writing from
the
department?
No, it was a phone call to our budget office.
See, I just don't remember that part being true.
And actually, they were also told, I just found out this morning, that there might have been another 0.5% cut out of the 2% insurance surcharge, but they couldn't find any proof of that, so I don't know if that's true or not, or hearsay. But we were told it was redirected.
I just don't remember that being true. So we might have to explore that a little more with the Department of Revenue and ask for a clarification with the Department of Revenue, did you say, or Finance?
It was the Department of Finance.
Department of Finance. And we might have to take the resources that we had with available to us and search their memories. Also, because I don't think we would have allowed that to happen. But nevertheless, you are in a difficult situation. And you said that this year you received $1.9 million less than you had.
That was in 2007. We had been receiving approximately $3.8 million, which was the amount that we paid each year. Mm-hmm. And I need a magnifying glass, actually. My budget manager made the print so small, I don't think I can read it. We had received $3,824,000 from 2003-04-05, $3.9 million in 2006, and $2.1 million in 2007. And looking at the Department of Finance's most recent projections, we're assuming that we'll be losing another $500,000 in 2008 at a minimum.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Well, thank you for that clarification, and thanks for coming down.
Thank you for the opportunity. Yeah.
Before us is the omnibus pension. Bill, House File 3082, Senate File 2720. Mr. Martin, do you want to give us a quick review?
Members,
Madam Chairman,
Representative Kahn,
I have another proposed amendment to it that I've spoken about. I don't know at what point you want
it. Let's have the quick review, and then we'll pick up the amendments.
Okay, thanks.
Just to remind everybody that what was contained therein between February, March, April, and today.
Members, you have a document in April 11th. Summary from me relates to actions through the April 9th commission meeting. As of that date, you had added 34 bills into the omnibus pension bill, and then you now have a 35th with the bill processed today. We've boiled them down into 16 different articles. The first two relate to the post fund, either if it continues or if it dissolves. The third article has to do with the reemployed annuitant or phased retirement provisions. Article 4 has to do with shifting from a single life annuity as the primary benefit form to joint and automatic 50% joint and survivor as the default benefit form. Five is a compilation of the various administrative provisions that were proposed for this year. Article 6 has to do with the MSRS correctional plan and coverage expansions in that plan. Article 7 has to do with the unclassified employees retirement program. That's chiefly the provision that relates to the question about the legislators and if and when there's a return to the or a choice of the general plan benefits. Article 8 relates to privatizations of primarily hospitals. Article 9 is a redirection of or clarification on some of retirement state aid related to the first class city teachers and TRA as a successor to Minneapolis. Article 10 has to do with the Minsky IRAP and related changes. Article 11 is changes in financial and actuarial reporting. Article 12 is the various provisions that related to either 403B annuities or the state deferred compensation program or other deferred compensation programs and the employer match. Article 13 has to do with local police and paid fire. This is, at the moment, a Minneapolis fire provision. Article 14 is the volunteer fire plan changes. This is primarily the contents of the items recommended to you by the State Auditor's Working Group, plus an increase in the lump sum and monthly benefits upper-end service pension maximums, and the creation of a board to oversee the further formulation of the statewide volunteer fire plan. Article 15 has to do with the provision relating to withholding membership dues by the various pension funds for the benefit of a labor organization or organizations. And 16 is the various small group or one-person bills to which the bill you processed today, the Hoppe bill, would be added. Beyond the broad thrust summary on pages 2, 3, and 4. There's a section-by-section summary, which goes another 10 pages or so, which gives you the bill from whence the provision came, as well as the contents of that bill. There are a couple of staff and related cleanup amendments, things we've either been told about or have discovered that are problematic with the bill. If you'd like to start there,
I would,
rather than the substantive changes that may occur.
Thank you, Mr. Martin.
For the sake of paper flow, we didn't throw these in your packets, but we are passing them out because there will be a lot of single pages, and it may be difficult to keep track of them if they're all together in a clump. The document that you're being handed out is document 8A. This is the wholly non-substantive changes. These are corrections in either grammatical problems or in one case, if you look on page 1, lines 31 and 32, this was an error that was made in the first meeting of the commission relating to a Minsky faculty member, where we had some bobble on her dates of hire, and we couldn't get it straight at the commission meeting, and this amendment has been riding along in the summaries for a couple of meetings now. So these are various corrections of a wholly non-substantive change nature.
I'll move the 8A amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of 8A. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. 8A.
Members, the next document we have for you is the 16A amendment. This relates to the statewide volunteer fire plan. We believe this is an oversight that you think you've done this, but there actually was not a motion to this effect. And so there's an appropriation to PERA for the statewide volunteer fire plan. Testimony from PERA and otherwise was that PERA was willing to cover the cost of the development of this plan internally with a bill back at some future date, and that there would not need to be an appropriation, but there never was an actual motion to remove that appropriations language from the amendment we were working from. So we believe you want to do this but have not done this. So if we're correct in that belief, then the 16A amendment would be appropriate.
Ms. Vanek, do we want... Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes. The board did discuss this last week at their board meeting, and they approved that we go ahead and do it.
Okay, thank you.
I'll move the 16A amendment, Madam Chair.
Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor of adoption of 16A, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Amendment is adopted.
Members, the next document that you have is the 17A amendment. In the bill, in Article 12, there's a recodification, in effect, of the deferred compensation program. The reviser pointed out this problem. Current law in MSRS deferred comp or Minnesota deferred comp plan has a 30-day provision related to a waiting period. The recodification suggested 60 days. Staff raised an issue whether 60 was the right number of days. MSRS suggested that you adopt that particular staff amendment, which left a date, a blank to be filled in, and there was no blank filled in. Since 30 is the current law and 60 was apparently too long, indicated by accepting that particular amendment, this language splits the difference at 45 to get off the dime, as it were. If that's not the right number of days, then you get the opportunity by a verbal amendment to get the right number of days. So this fills in a blank that is currently in the draft bill.
Mr. Bergstrom, does 45 days sound good? Acceptable? He says yes.
And I'll move the 17A amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of 17A. Further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
The next document we have for you is the 15A amendment. This relates to the money that is current, would be redirected. This relates to Article 9 of the bill. The three first-class city teacher plans once received state aid. Duluth, when it became fully funded, no longer qualified for state aid sometime back around the 2000. There was an automatic redistribution of the Duluth aid, which was put in some flux by amendments to this provision in 2006 and 2007. So the provision that's in the bill right now relates to clarifying that redistribution. Some of it would go to St. Paul and some of it would go to TRA for reflecting Minneapolis teachers' share. The St. Paul share is being redirected at the request of St. Paul teachers to fund the actuary to be retained by the Pension Commission. And the due date or the effective date of that appropriation that's in the amendment, the omnibus amendment reflecting the work that the commission has done, indicates a 2010 date. And Mr. Kapler suggests that there's no reason not to do this at 2009. And so this language is in this amendment. And you may want to have Mr. Kapler suggest to you what his thinking is with 2010 and why 2009 is now the appropriate date.
Mr. Kappa? Amendment 15A?
Yes, Madam Chair, members. This is a technical amendment. The way that the bill was originally drafted, the intent by having the year fiscal year 2010 be the commencement date for that appropriation to the Pension Commission for their own consulting actuary and oversight actuary was simply to push the fiscal impact because there was no alternative funding source identified at that point in time. It would have been a fresh expenditure out of the general fund, was to push that into the next biennium. That, in effect, well, it created a tail in the original draft of the bill. But the language relative to the reallocated, no longer in effect, Duluth direct state amortization aid, it's being reallocated out of that pot that otherwise would have gone to St. Paul, so the year is rolled back to fiscal year 2009, so on July 1 of this year, you actually have an appropriation and can hire an actuary. That's what the date change was for. It is fiscally neutral, Madam Chair. There is no general fund impact.
Mr. Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, I agree it's fiscal neutral, but it's certainly not cash flow neutral. I don't know. I don't know why we want to do this.
You don't know what?
I'm not sure why we want to move it ahead of here. I'm sorry if I missed that.
Mr. Kapler.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, is that I'm not sure I understand the question.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I do. I'm just trying to figure this out.
I think what she's asking is why the $140,000 coming from TRA?
St. Paul.
Or St. Paul Teachers?
Yeah.
Is that what you're asking, Senator?
Well, Madam Chair, we're just changing the date, just the year, correct? Nothing else.
Because is it that we want the commission to be hiring their actuary at the same time that the funds are hiring theirs?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, members, yes. That's the commission's prerogative, I guess. But the money in the other amendment that adjusted the amount going to St. Paul freed up $140,000 in the coming fiscal year. And, I mean, there's a considerable amount of lead time search for an actuary that's going to have to be conducted, and presumably you'll be interviewing candidates and selecting. And there are startup costs involved before the actuary is even reviewing evaluation, but we'll be doing, in this bill, we'll be doing actuarial valuations. The funds will be submitting valuations according to Pension Commission standards for the fiscal year to come, July 1, 2008. So the valuations that you receive in, we pray, October and early November would be coming to the commission, and if you want an actuary reviewing those for compliance with standards and reasonableness of the figures that the commission's looking at, you would have to have an actuary on board to do that, independently for you. And this makes that appropriation effective and available at that time.
Is there anyone that objects to the amendment changing 2010 to 2009?
Madam Chair, then I'll move the 15A amendment.
Any further discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Members, that handles all of the technical amendments and all of the substantive amendments that were more on the technical end than the substantive end.
Madam Chair, I will go ahead.
Well, Representative Kahn?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I have an amendment that... that I admit I probably should have put in bill form, but I kept thinking it came in too late to do this, and I was... kept being surprised at how later we kept on... going. So, my apologies, but it, I think.
We have acquired in the last 10 minutes two volunteer pages from the page stack, so we very much appreciate that you're willing to come. Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, this amendment was brought to me by Dale McDonald, who works for the lottery, and it's I guess I was particularly he's divorced, and apparently it's the unusual case before the pension commission of someone trying to be nice to an ex-wife, and he's not ready to retire. But his ex-wife apparently is ill and is likely and will need to stop working. And he would like to have an early division of the marital So she's he'd like to her to be able to collect her part of the pension before he retires. And so this is the language that's been done to do this. It has no fiscal effect on the committee, and I actually believe that they had talked to Dave Bergstrom about it before, but Dave Bergstrom doesn't seem to have any problems with it.
Mr. Bergstrom?
And there is a memo from the pension staff and attached to the amendment.
Mr. Bergstrom.
Madam Chair, I'm Dave Bergstrom, the Director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. I do think the amendment does not have a cost impact on MSRS. You did something similar, actually, for a former legislator last year. What I have a preference, if it's possible to do it as an individual bill, so we could come back and study the policy as a whole. I'm comfortable with the way it's worded, but you know, we've done something for legislators' plan. This deals with unclassified plan, and we have a lot of other plans. So I have a slight preference if there's a way to make it an individual bill. I know it's late, and I don't know if you can do that, but otherwise, I think the language works for us. Quite frankly, I think we actually could make money on this. And because if I read it right, if they qualify for Rule of 90, they split the service credit, so they may lose some Rule of 90 eligibility. So in certain cases, we actually could end up, you know, the participant could end up with less of a pension than anticipated.
But, Mr. Bergstrom, then, if we are able to help Mr. McDonnell with 5A, Amendment 5A, we couldn't insert Darby from Two Harbors' name in there and help her, could we? Because her settlement depends on their divorce decree. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, that would be correct. We would need to look into it a little bit further. And you know, each of these cases is fairly unique when you get into divorces, so it would be nice to have more of the detail and the facts. And you know, if you want to do something down the line, I certainly could come back for that specific person after I had a chance to look more closely at it.
Mr. Martin, can we change this just for Mr. McDonnell?
Members, I don't know that I can suggest on the fly what needs to be changed, because I lack at least some of the relevant dates that I would need to reference to make it effective only for one person. But that certainly, with those dates and whatever supplied by Mr. Bergstrom or otherwise, I could do that, yes.
Is that okay with you, Representative Kahn? Yes. Will you put that in your motion, please?
Yes. So I would like to move this with the appropriate changes to make it apply to the one person.
Representative Kahn moves adoption of 27 with the changes for particular person, Mr. McDonnell. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Betzel, or Senator Betzel.
Yeah, thank
I'm
you, Madam
sorry.
Chair. I have two amendments. One is 14A. And I'll describe that. This deletes page 125, section 6. That relates to a individual buyback for a Hennepin County commissioner. We heard this, I believe, last February. I've had discussions with PERA since then, and at the time that we came forward with this, they didn't seem to think that there were other people in the pipeline or around that might be affected by this. PERA, on second thoughts, had wanted to take another look at this because they could very well have broader implications with, say, some county attorneys and so forth who want to buy back service and they're not quite sure whether the amount that they pegged as the actuarial amount is the actual, is the appropriate number. And it also may be affected with this particular individual whether or not if this were to pass, whether or not he seeks re-election, goes into a different plan if he's re-elected. And none of that is known right now. So it's my understanding that the county commissioner has discussed this with PRA, and he'd still like to, you know, have something done. But you know, he's at this point in time, I think, in agreement to having this pulled from the bill, so we can take a little bit more time to look at it. And if PRA or I think Mr. Rice is here to discuss that, they can do that as well.
Okay. Is there any discussion? All in favor of adoption of Senator Betzel's Amendment 14A, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
And Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
I have a 10A amendment as well. At our last meeting, we had a bill that had two components to it. And the first part was regarding employment of firefighters. And Senator Olson had a number of questions as to whether a current law would suffice and so forth. That is not being offered here. The second part of the amendment, however, did deal with the duty disability for people who had extensive service. And Ms. Vanek had testified that that was one of the issues that they were open to negotiating and discussing further. This was a change that was made last year with the changes in disabilities. But it's my understanding that PERA has had further discussions and had an opportunity to review it, and that now, on consideration, it's my understanding they're okay with adopting this section. And I, again, believe Ms. Vanek and Mr. Rice can discuss this as well.
Was this the Nelson Amendment
yes.
last time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you want discussion? Senator Olson?
I was just going to say, Madam Chair, that my concern really was with the first part of this that we talked about before, which that part had to do with what I felt would be a different standard for disability, for defining disability than we have under current law, and that isn't in here, so I'm fine.
That's not offered.
Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
Just for my clarification, was that the reemployment piece of it, the part that required cities or local units for, okay, and so that's not being offered here?
It's not offered.
Any further discussion? Okay, all in favor of adoption, Senator Betzel's motion to adopt 10A, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn, and then.
Oh. Okay, I have one more amendment, which is an amendment that we've, you know, I'm not sure how many times this has been proposed or has come. It's an issue that I think the House is in agreement on, and last time, I don't recall if we did it in the Pension Commission or in Government Operations, but it's on the, get this out. What it is it's dealing with the Pension Commission membership, and I have two problems with the Pension Commission membership, is that I would like there to be more. This is a very small group compared to most House and Senate committees, and I would like there to be more people in the legislature who understand pension issues. The other problem I have is the only having only one minority member on the Pension Commission. I would like to have more minority members, which in a when you're looking at the margins in the House and the Senate is not really likely with what the ratios are such, so that four to one is more appropriate than 3-2. So my proposal is to expand the commission to a membership of 14. It's at one point in past history, I don't remember how many years ago, the House had proposed this, and the House had proposed the going to 14, and the Senate wanted to keep it at 5, and we did what turned out to be the worst thing possible, which is that we compromised at 6. When you compromised at 6, it turned out what you did is that you increased the membership on each side by one, but you increase the quorum number by two instead of by one. And so this time, even though you increase the quorum number, you have more people to supply the quorum. So the one year where we had this increased quorum, where we had a quorum number of, I guess for membership of 12, we had a quorum number of 7, and we needed 4 from each side. It was often problem times when that became a problem. But to increase it by this number, we give us more people to help us make the quorum. It arithmetically works out better. The only point of that last thing was to say that 6 doesn't work at all. But I would prefer 7. I think it would be very helpful. I know the Senate did a super job with putting new people on it who came right along, but I would like there to be more people in the legislature to understand pension matters, and I would like there to be more members of the minority on the Pension Commission. And I don't think 14 is an unusably large size. So I don't remember where we've done it in the past. We might have done it in government operations instead of in the Pension Commission. I know it came out in a conference committee.
Senator Fedham.
And Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I have not talked to my members about this at all. I have a concern that I expressed last year, the fact that, in the Senate, we have some very large committees and we have some rather small committees. It has sort of seemed to me that when we have small committees, people tend to be more engaged in the work. They show up. I think all senators are, showing interest in so forth. It's just the larger the committee, the easier it is to say, I don't need to show up as often, or I got other things to do because I've got so much on my agenda, and it almost gets to a point of diminishing returns. And I know that the members, the new members of the Senate, were basically handpicked because they. And that's why it took so long for the Senate to make its appointments, because we wanted people who basically were going to be showing up, people who were going to take the job seriously, people who are smart, who are going to be able to learn this, because it takes a long time, as we know, to understand a lot of this, and that we want those kind of people on the Pension Commission. I'm not saying that we don't have a few more people in the Senate who aren't capable of that, but I think that trying to make sure that we get the best work and the quality work out of those that we have, I think is a goal that I have, and I'm just concerned that you start making it too big, you start losing a bit of that. So I'm a bit concerned about that.
Well, Madam Chairman.
Representative Kahn.
I would agree if the number I had suggested was 20 instead of 14, but I think 14 is a very workable group. In fact, I think I had a class in group theory which says something like 13 and 14 is the exact perfect number for a group size for group deliberations, or something like that. My concern is that I think we need more people in both bodies who understand the pension issue, and the other concern is that it would, I think, I know that Representative Smith and Senator Wergen are terrific members, but I again think it would be good to have another minority, that they could have company of one person in their caucus to talk to on this, on these issues. And I just think it's a, it's very hard for people to learn this and to take it on. In fact, even just coming back to it, I remember before the first committee when I picked up the set of bills and I started reading them before, I said, I don't know this. I don't remember any of these words. I don't remember any of the things that we do. And it kind of gradually comes back as you do it. But I just think the legislature could use, it's a really important issue as we found, and I think the legislature could use more people understanding it in depth as the Pension Commission members get to do.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just showing my ignorance here, I'm just wondering if there is a definition somewhere in statute of the minority caucus membership,
because we're making a reference here, if we adopted this in statute to something, and I don't know if it has a, is it defined somewhere in statute?
I think specifically there are places like in, I believe, LCMR and LCCMR, we specifically talk about we don't allow it just to chance. It may be also in the LAC. We may sometimes use the language of the caucus, you know, when there have been, I guess there are three caucuses in the House right now. We've sometimes used it as the least, the second most populous caucus or something like that. I don't think it's a problem. I don't know how it's referred to in those other sections. I know there are places where we definitely call for members, and there might be better wording than the use of the word minority. We all know what we mean, and I don't think it's a problem unless you got, you know, some kind of a co-equal caucus that wasn't the majority.
Well, Madam
you have
Chair,
a minority leader.
Sarah Olson. I don't know. I guess I just think if we put it in statute, it has to be related, a term like that. It has to be somehow defined somewhere, because otherwise, you know, different caucuses kind of come and go over time in terms of their membership and their qualifications, and so... This is something that's permanent, and we should know exactly what we're talking about and what we're reflecting, I would think.
Mr. Shepherd, do you have a definition? Is there a definition in statute that you know of?
Madam Chair and members, I'm Mark Shepherd from the House Research Department. No, I don't know of a definition. I suppose another way to state this would be to say that no more than five members from each chamber may be members of the political party with the largest representation in that chamber.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that would sort of self-define it.
Technically, Madam Chair, I think majority caucus can... I mean, there can only be one majority. There can be numerous minorities. So I think what Mr. Shepherd suggests, if you identify it saying that no more majority, you know, can be, so I think that would suffice as well, too. And, of course, I mean, if you have seven, you could theoretically have a point in time when it could be four and three, I mean, instead of five or two.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it was at least,
yeah.
You know, it wasn't meant to be limitations, but... Sure, if that's a better way of doing it. Although I do think that we do this in other places, but maybe it's exactly the phrase that Mr. Shepherd has suggested.
And Mr. Martin, you have a budget, right? And that budget, does that go up from biennium to biennium?
Madam Chair, having the chairs of the two budget divisions that handle the commission budget, I'm somewhat... Yes, it does go up modestly, unless all budgets are being reduced, and then it goes down modestly.
And, Mr. Martin, if the per diems and the mileages were included for seven members or 14 members rather than 12 members?
Ten
members, yes. What impact would that have, especially if one of these new people, two of these new people that were to be appointed, or four of these new people, were from rural Minnesota?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure it would have a huge impact for the balance of this fiscal year, because the amendment does not come into effect until January 1, 2009, and the 2009 session would be a long session. It's unlikely you would have many commission meetings prior to June 30, 2009. But that would become the base for subsequent budgets, and a five-member or a 10-member commission base then feeding into a 14-member commission on an ongoing basis after this coming biennium ends. would not probably be captured very well, and the budget is somewhat narrow at the moment. It's a doable budget, but there is no slack in our budget. So if this becomes the base for future years and the membership increases by 40%, I do have some difficulties potentially. The farther away, mileage is a major component, because the longer the mileage, the more likely a member has to come down the day before with a double per diem.
So the House has done a better job of being fiscally responsible with membership than the Senate. I don't think it's something.
don't spoil it. Any further discussion? All in favor of adoption of A1, the con amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion does not prevail. But I bet it's not the last time we're going to see it. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the 21A amendment.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, this has to do with the 403B provision with regard to school districts. And I voiced some concern about this when we initially discussed that. And since that time, I've been further contacted by a number of school districts across the state of Minnesota, who have voiced some concerns about this. And as I thought about it and took a further look at this, I think that it's important to point out that the extent to which school districts or bargaining units would desire to include in their terms and conditions of employment the 403B provision, they certainly have the ability today to choose to do that or to choose not to do that. And it frankly further troubled me a bit that this provision largely came before the commission as the result of one school district's seemingly unfortunate series of events surrounding a situation like this. From the district's perspective, I'm concerned that this puts the district in a compromised position in terms of their ability to be able to negotiate with vendors, and it should come as no surprise to anyone that I continue to be a pretty strong proponent of local control. I don't want to suggest that this might not be something that a district or a bargaining unit might choose to entertain locally. But I do not think, at least at this particular point in time, that we need to statutorily mandate this.
Discussion? Senator Betzel. Yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair. I'm supportive of this. I've had time to think about it, and I've got some contacts about this issue as well, too. There probably should be a way when we can have more opportunities for more vendors. I don't know exactly what the answer is. Maybe this opens it up way too much, and I think we do have to be a little bit careful about having retirement issues just thrown out to the collective bargaining process. There's a purpose and there's some limits on collective bargaining, and I agree with Senator Lynch that maybe we'll just take a step back and think about this a little bit more.
Was that Mr. Beam? Yeah. Mr. Deans, you spoke about this amendment the last time from the School Boards Association.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, and you were opposed to us putting this in.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you know how many people, how many school districts do not offer a variety or an option, more than one option, for their 403s?
Madam Chair, my name is Tom Deans. I'm legal counsel in the School Board Association. I don't know exactly how many vendors each school district deals with. I would point out, however, that regardless of the number of vendors, that has nothing to do with the number of offerings that you have. If you had a single vendor, let me just pick one for whatever reason. Let's say that you had Fidelity. And Fidelity's got hundreds of offerings that they have for 403B and 401K type plans, you know, that you have that come from a single vendor. So it's not, you don't just have one vendor and you just have one thing that you can do. You have lots of options. The question here is how many vendors are you going to have?
And would you state again what your opposition was?
Yes. Madam Chair, under the old law, this was sort of an unregulated area. Now there are new IRS regulations that are coming into place that will be effective January 1, 2009. Those regulations say that the school district is the responsible entity to enforce these plans, and that all the plans that are offered by the school district through multiple vendors are treated as one plan. So if you had six or seven vendors and one vendor is out of whack, that throws the entire school district out of whack under the new IRS regulations that go into effect.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm a little bit uncomfortable changing my position on this unless there's someone here to testify on the other side of this.
Oh, I'm going to ask them to come down here.
But my crux of my concern goes to the statement that because of these IRS regulations, it says that the school districts are now going to be caught in a catch-22 of using only 403B vendors that are willing to comply with the new IRS regulations, and then also attempting to bargain a list of vendors with multiple employee groups. And I'm wondering how big a problem that really is, because it would seem to me that if the IRS is promulgating new rules, that if a vendor wants to stay in the market, that they would comply with whatever those rules are. And if that isn't true, I mean, how limiting really is this? And if you're going to have to comply anyway with those rules, are you going to have, is it going to be that difficult to say, to just make that one of the conditions that you would bargain with the Education Minnesota group, is that, or the school, the teachers in your district, is that they have to meet this criteria? I mean, doesn't that still, because on the one hand we have the issue of local control, and that's something that I think we all care about. On the other hand, we have the issue of allowing people to make their own decisions regarding what they think is the wisest or safest investment for their retirement funds. And especially now that people are putting more of their own money into retirement instead of having, you know, defined benefits, that's also a valid consideration. So I'm just wondering, why is this really a serious problem?
Mr. Deans.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I understand that concern. The problem is the liability in this regard will rest on us if we end up doing it wrong. If let's take the example, since the chair mentioned it, of the Osseo School District, which is the one that litigated this issue. The Osseo School District had quite a number of vendors that were out there. The Osseo School District also has 24 bargaining units that it would have to bargain this with. Doing that and doing the due diligence to find out whether or not that particular entity's program is in compliance with the law, when you're at the bargaining table and you're trying to decide who that entity is going to be, is something that's in many cases going to be beyond the ability of those school board members or those administrators that are at that table. I mean, they're going to have to get somebody else in. This is, you know, it's a fairly, when you've got a lot of these, this is a fairly big administrative requirement to make sure that these things are in compliance. In the old days, you know, nobody checked up to see if they were in compliance, so it wasn't a big deal. But now the Internal Revenue Service is checking up, and they are going to enforce this, and they've made this a priority, and the regs have been out here, and people are going to have to do it. In the past, with the litigation only applied to unmatched 403B plans. On the matched plans, you know, that are in the deferred comp law, the statute provides that the school district can determine how many vendors and can determine who the vendors are and how many there are and the hours that the teachers can talk to them or the employees. And as I said the other day when I testified, we had thought that provision applied to all of these vendors. As it turns out, it was drafted more narrowly and only applies to the matched ones. The proposed legislation appears to apply to both. So you'll have a conflict between the existing law and this provision as well. Senator, I think that's perhaps the best that I can do. This will create a fairly large administrative hardship. We don't, you know, I would hope that they would all be in compliance, but there's lots of folks out there, and we'll have to track it down and do the due diligence on each one.
Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just suggest that the provision before us is not about 403Bs. It's not about whether or not they're in compliance or not in compliance or how administratively a district is going to handle that. The issue before us is whether or not 403B plans should statutorily be a term and condition of employment. That's the question before us.
Thank you, Mr. Deans.
Thank you.
Ms. Halschweiger, please come and remind us why this was a good provision and that why it should be in the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Alswiger, Education, Minnesota. 403Bs were developed, and 401Ks really were developed for people to have some choice in how they invest their own money. If you take out this amendment, because of the court ruling in the Osseo School District, the employees would not have any choice about where they put their money, which vendors, and what vendors are available. And so it is the employees' money. Nothing in this legislation changes the requirements of the school districts. Nothing. Nothing changes about IRS regulations. They already have to do this. Why are they opposing it? Because they want to go to one so that our some of them, I can't say that generally, that would not be fair. But they want to reduce it so that employees don't have the choice to make it easier for them. Nothing in this legislation changes that because of IRS regulations. They say that it will create an administrative hardship. Actually, I think if you collectively bargain with the teachers and the unions, and you spell out the problem, if there is a problem, they will listen and they will come to understand the need and the interest and reduce it accordingly. All we are saying is that we want our teachers and other school employees to be able to have at least some say. It doesn't mean they can't reduce. It doesn't mean they couldn't increase, which I don't think is probably going to happen. But why should we let the school administrators make all the decisions about where the employee monies are? They might have relationship with vendors. They could go to funds that have more fees. It doesn't make sense not to have them as part of the discussion.
Further discussion? Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, Ms. Allswager, I kind of see a different problem, and that's that, as Mr. Deans mentioned, there's 24 bargaining units, I think he said, with Osseo. Everybody, including myself, kind of has their favorite place and their favorite way to want to invest their funds, and I get that because it's a pretty important thing. But what happens then if you have, even let's just say, 8 bargaining units to bring it way down, which is probably more typical than 24 by all means, and each of those bargaining units then, by virtue of being able to insert names into their contract, because an employee or whatever small group of employees has a favorite, then within each bargaining contract, there's, let's just keep the number way down, there's 3, but you could potentially have 24 different ones because there's 8 different bargaining units. Doesn't it become cumbersome? At least to me, it seems like it would be a cumbersome administration piece to have to be working with 24 different agencies or companies, whatever you will, to fulfill what's in each of those bargaining contracts for the purpose of investing, when, in fact, if you had 3 total, because I agree, 1 probably isn't a good idea. If you had 3 total, you'd still have the diversity of where your funds could go. In other words, if you're using 3 companies that are substantial, then you do have a great diversity of investment possibilities with just 3, and you don't have the cumbersome nature of having to deal with 24. To me, it seems like to specify company names within the contract gets cumbersome because of the number of bargaining units within some, if not all, of our districts.
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, well, typically how some of this would go, if you're an efficiently run school district like many are, you would have a discussion about legislation such as this, where you would bring representatives from all the bargaining units together and say, okay, here's our issue. We've got to figure out what we're going to do here to make some changes. The school district thinks that maybe we have too many vendors, and we'd like to figure out how many plans we would offer within that, whatever, so that, you know, don't have 24. And you come to some agreement maybe in an informal meeting, and then when they go back to the bargaining table, they do the stamp of approval through their vote process and everything. This does not have to be that difficult at all. What is happening, however, is with the Osseo court decision, they're basically saying that, and the School Board Association is obviously supporting this as an outcome, that a school district can come and say only one vendor. And we don't think that's right. But with the current law, that is the position that we must take to have it collectively bargained. So we think that this is a compromise that is clearly one of negotiations in the spirit of trying to compromise to solve problems. If the administration, the school district, thinks it's a problem, let's come to the table and talk about it. But it is the employees' money, and why would we tell them that they can pick who an employee must invest their money in if they have a 403, they want a 403B, who and how many? I think it's only fair to have that discussion. I would suggest that we do this. Let's see how it works. Because I don't think anybody here at the table really wants a district to go down to 1. And frankly, that is what the MSBA is defending. So let's pass it and see what happens and see if it's a difficult problem. I don't believe it is.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I don't have anything drafted at this point, but I'm wondering if, you know, maybe the compromise isn't something like not making it a bargaining item, but saying that they have to have at least three vendors or something like that, or that they can't have less than three vendors. And that seems to me that we could draft an amendment to that effect. That might be the compromise that would make people maybe not comfortable, but happier than they would be with, you know, one group getting it being all or nothing kind of a situation.
Madam Chair and Ms. Senator Olson, we would certainly believe that the employee should be a part of that discussion, and it should not be a decision made by the school board or superintendents. So we would prefer our language strongly.
Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, Ms. Olswiger, I would understand that if you could actually not necessarily point me or tell me the name of a company, but show me where it's practiced that the employees tell the company, here's the funds or here's the ones that we want you to handle. Where in any other sector, be it private or public, is this negotiated for the names of the firms to be used in a union contract?
Madam Salzweiger. Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, I don't have that information. I don't have it, so I would have to check on that and try to get back to you.
Senator Lynch.
Madam Chair, I would move adoption of the 21A amendment.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. Motion does not prevail.
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Subsequent to that motion, then I have the A23 or 23A, whatever it is. Thank you, Madam Chair. This deals with exactly the same section. The A23 amendment takes page 82, line 17, and simply deletes the two words identity and, so that it remains part of the negotiations to develop a number of companies to deal with, but not necessarily the names of the companies to deal with. So if a school district, for instance, does have five or six bargaining units, and it says three, and one bargaining unit says four, the crossover can be three of them the same in one, and the fourth one is added as a result of another bargaining unit saying it. But it isn't quite as cumbersome as having so many companies. I think it actually is a compromise, such as Senator Olson was talking about.
So that lock is still there. Any discussion, Mr. Deans?
Madam Chair, my understanding, Tom Deans, my understanding is that this takes out the reference to the identity, but we would negotiate the number. And we negotiate that with each unit?
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Deans, under either scenario, it's negotiated with each unit. As it is in the bill currently, the name and number identify, yes, with each unit. This would just the number. and the meeting of the minds on just the numbers, the fact that if one contract calls for three vendors and one calls for four, three of the four could be the same, where in the other scenario, if you have a contract with three names spelled out and a contract with four names spelled out, it could be seven different companies instead of four total. So this definitely, I think, brings it into a more workable realm with having just the number.
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, I know that you're trying to help. I'm not 100% convinced that really helps, because the real problem is still here. You're still negotiating retirement benefits and how you're going to do this. But I'm, you know, it's probably better than what's in here now. But it still also doesn't address the other issue, whether this applies to matched and unmatched plans, or whether it only applies to the unmatched plans. But
thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Mr. Deans, I agree. It's not the perfect answer. I was just asking if it was better.
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen, the problem is I honestly can't tell, because it's fine if we negotiate two with eight of the unions and then the other one's got 15, then I don't know that we have to order have 15 across the board. So
Ms. Osweiger.
Madam Chair, Senator Wergen and Pension Commission, Jan Osweiger, Education Minnesota. First of all, it conflicts with the basic premise of our legislation, so we would oppose it. But there is also something that has just recently come to my attention as vendors put forward proposals to public employers. One of the pieces of information is called a 12B1V, and it shows the revenue sharing that a 403B vendor might be involved with. In other words, a school district might decide to pick on a 403B vendor that is involved in revenue sharing. In other words, the 403B vendor might decide to pick up some of the administrative costs or save some money for the district, but and make decisions based on that versus the amount of fees that the employee pays or based on the rate of return. That is why you must have employees involved in this process to have the discussion, so that it is not just a profit making, and I believe it wouldn't be a huge profit, but it certainly would be something that would be considered, so that the decision being made on revenue versus the cost to the employees. So this is something that's new to me. I've just learned about it, and I want to do some more investigating. I would strongly urge you to let this go at this point. I'll do some more work, try to get more information, and as it goes through the committee, if there's something I can learn, I'll be happy to share that with you. But this goes back to the basic premise that we believe that this is employees' money, and they should have a part of the discussion about who they're paying their money to, how much that rate of return has been over the last few years, what would be the fees that they're being that they would have to pay, and is the district getting a kickback or not?
Senator Wergen.
Madam Chair, Ms. Osweiger, isn't it also employer contributions or matches? I mean, I know it's employee funds, but isn't it also public dollars, in that it's the school district doing a match also in all of them?
Yes, you are correct, but it is the dollars then of the employee. But yes, they were some of the dollars in an employer match would originate from the employer, but they would be employee money then. Yes.
But Ms. Osweiger, isn't it also true that an employee can put in more than what is matched?
Absolutely. Two limits within law, but yes, they can put in more than that is matched that would be solely their money. And there might be some districts that don't have any matches. I'm not sure about that either.
Senator Larson.
Madam Chair and Ms. Allswager, how does each district arrive at what its match amount is? Is that bargained for?
Madam Chair and Senator Larson, those dollar amounts are part of the whole negotiations process, and generally it isn't the top item on the list of items that teachers are negotiating for or other school employees, and it's usually a smaller amount as compared to salary. And I believe a pension commission staff can probably tell me better right now, though. I think that there's a fairly small maximum contribution that's allowed at this point.
Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
I guess as a follow-up to that, Madam Chair and Ms. Allswager, so it is the result of part of the collective bargaining process. Teachers are bargaining with the school district. Does the school district then have to bargain with all those other units, the eight units that people refer to, regarding those same numbers?
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, yes, you're absolutely right. 403Bs are part of the collective bargaining process in probably most all districts. I just can't tell you exactly how many. Yes, and it probably is the case in most of the bargaining units across the state, too.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm trying to drive at here, and Mr. Deans, maybe you can respond to that, is aren't there a number of issues where school districts have to address multiple bargaining units with similar issues that may turn out differently? And how is this different from that?
Mr. Deans.
Ms. Chairman, that would be the issue that you're dealing with there is how much would that match be? Ms. Allswager has said that it's pretty minuscule. I'll point out to you, however, you're increasing the match under this bill to $7,500 or something around that. So this is going to be a major issue at the table. But let me point out to you that the statute presently for those matched ones, the court case dealt with unmatched ones, the statute is in 356.24, sub 1B. That's the deferred comp statute, sub 1B. And that says a school board for school district employees may establish limits on the number of vendors of plans covered by the exceptions set forth in sub 1. That's the match provisions. And that will utilize the conditions under which those vendors may contact employees both during working hours and after working hours. This provision wasn't even covered by the Osseo case. This has been the law for years that the school districts, on those match plans, that the school districts can limit the number of vendors. And this would overrule that. And you know, we really disagree with that. I've got to make at least some statement when Ms. Allswager is getting up and talking about kickbacks to the school district. I mean, I take pretty big offense at that. They've got a wholly owned subsidiary that they've got out here that's one of the vendors, and they're talking about us taking kickbacks under this thing. That's ridiculous, and I think that's offensive.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I guess at the risk of not making anyone happy, I think I'm going to support Senator Workin's compromise as kind of a reasonable compromise, but I understand the point being made about a potential conflict with any other law, so we probably should address that by saying something like notwithstanding any other statute to the contrary or something like that, if this is, you know, so to make it clear that this is taking precedence. Maybe it is anyway because it's the most recently passed law, but I'm just wondering if council can tell us if that would be a way to avoid that conflict or would it be necessary to do that?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Martin,
a notwithstanding clause certainly could be added. the only time you get to trying to figure out timing is if the two provisions cannot be read together. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure that the absence of any limit in one and the presence of a limit in the other is necessarily diametrically opposed and couldn't be read together. So if you, I don't know that you've got an absolute conflict that you'd have to resolve, that you can have for matched a limit and for unmatched no limit. I don't know that that causes necessarily a conflict. Mm-hmm. Clearly you could put a notwithstanding clause, and I can give you the citation relatively quickly, but I'm not sure there is as big a conflict as it might be portrayed.
Further discussion. Sarah Wergen.
Madam Chair, I renew my motion for Amendment 23A.
Senator Wergen renews her motion to adopt Amendment 23A. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No. The motion does not prevail.
Division, Madam Chair.
Sarah Wergen asks for division. All in favor say aye. Motion does not prevail.
Madam Chair, I think I have a couple of amendments over
there. Military buyback?
No, that's not mine. I don't think.
It was.
Yeah, that's not the one I'm thinking of. Oh. You can send that one over too if you want.
Military buyback.
This one's not the military buyback. Okay. Let's start out with we could. Okay. It's the 25A amendment. The practical effect of the amendment, members, is that there was some money that was at one time directed to the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. That fund reached a certain trigger point when the money was redirected to the Minneapolis Teachers Fund, now is going to the TRA because of the merger. What this amendment would do would redirect this $346,000 back to the Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. What we're doing in the bill is removing some trigger language. Some of this money is also going to the St. Paul Teachers Fund. I think the real reason for this, the $346,000 doesn't make a huge amount of difference to TRA in terms of their funding, but for the Duluth teachers, it actually would make a significant difference. It was money that had been going to them when they had a shortfall, and they have a shortfall again. And so that's the essence of the amendment.
Any discussion? Sarah Olson?
Madam Chair, again, just for as a new member trying to understand this, when a particular account has a shortfall, is it because of things that have to do with their investments, maybe not panning out as well, and so you're you have a reason to move this around, or does it have to do with not making contributions at the same level, where you might have, one group that's maybe making higher levels of contributions not benefiting as much from available funds? Are these general funds that would be available to anyone, or are they specifically more likely to be related? I guess so the point I'm making is, as a policy matter, we don't want to be, rewarding groups that aren't making adequate contributions if that's part of it, if that's the problem. But I'm not sure if that has anything to do with this in terms of the of what we're actually accomplishing or what we're doing.
They're all making the same contributions.
Okay.
This time. It's Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The basically what we're doing in the bill currently in the section this is amending is it's kind of getting rid of obsolete language in some sense and reallocating it. And in the current language, $486,000 starting at, well, maybe Mr. Martin, do you want to explain the kind of the details of where the money flows were? Would that be?
Mr. Martin?
Members, yes, I would be happy to. The state started paying direct state aid to the first-class city teachers back in 1993, and that was primarily it was Minneapolis and St. Paul at that time. Subsequently, in 1997, there was Duluth was also granted aid, and as part of the 1997 benefit improvements piece of legislation. There were triggers that were placed in that legislation that redirected the money to the remaining less well-funded plan or plans as plans reached the level of funding that TRA had reached. And that's what happened in the case of Duluth. Then Minneapolis was consolidated, and TRA became the successor in interest to the various funding streams that went to Minneapolis. Although Duluth had been had its money reallocated automatically, no one ever came back, and it just good administrative practice ever captured that reallocation in statute. And the attempts in 2006 and 2007 to get this clarified that were attempted by TRA did not fully do what needed to be done, leaving the current contribution, the current state aid, in flux.
And so this is what we're doing in the legislation, Madam Chair, is to finally get it clarifying that. But as part of that, what this proposal would be is to take some of that money, and you can see where the money is going. TRA, $2.8 million is going to St. Paul, and $3.3 to TRA for the former Minneapolis Teachers Retirement Fund. This would take a portion of that TRA money, the 13.3, reduce that down to 12.9, and send $346,000 to Duluth. And Duluth is in a deficit situation right now, and this actually would have an impact on that. I know there's people here, there, even better.
Senator Solon?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do represent Duluth. I think Mr. Martin probably has explained this the best, but I think that Duluth was in a situation where it was doing so well that it no longer qualified for the distribution after 2002 until this point. And if there is talk about opening up or removing that cap on that, then Duluth feels like they should benefit also because I believe they're in a deficit situation and could make use of those funds now.
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, Jay Stoffel, Director of Duluth Teachers Retirement Fund. I don't want to be too redundant, but we did receive aid for 5 years. $486,000 was received by the Duluth Teachers Fund for 5 years. It was redirected at the point when our funding ratio exceeded that of the TRA. That was the language. It was not because we were overfunded, but because of our funding ratio was in excess of the TRA's ratio. That happened officially, according to the actuaries, one time, and that's when the aid was redirected to, at the time, Minneapolis Teachers and St. Paul Teachers, and now TRA is the successor to the Minneapolis Teachers' interest in that redirection. So at this present time, we're about the same funded as TRA, actually 1% less. They're 88% funded. We're 87% funded, and our deficiency is a little over 3%, and theirs is something closer to 1-something percent. So all we're really hoping for some discussion on this aid redirection question that's come up a couple times, and that Duluth teachers be included and considered in all of those conversations.
Is there anyone that opposes? Ms. Hawkins.
Laurie,
welcome
to the
TRA.
Madam Chair, while we're not coming up here to oppose this, we just want to take note that this money was part of the consolidation agreement and some $21.3 million in aid that TRA is receiving to help us handle the Minneapolis unfunded liabilities that came over to us. So while this is a small amount for us and much larger impact for Duluth, we just want to raise the point to make sure that this isn't a precedent because we are reliant on that large amount of aid that we do get to help us with the Minneapolis problems. So.
Thank you very much. Representative Thiessen, who is the author of the consolidation plan?
Representative Smith was, I think.
And who helped Representative Smith?
Yes.
Representative Thiessen?
I did, yes. And Representative Osmond, is that who it was? Okay.
Representative Thiessen?
So, Madam Chair, I mean, I think the key point here is that this $486,000 was going to Duluth until the trigger was hit. It was hit for 1 year, and then they fell back below the trigger again. So there was kind of this blip that they lost this money. We're now essentially removing the trigger provision so that it will never happen for St. Paul in the future. And so it seems in the equities of this would say we ought to take consideration for Duluth at this time and acknowledge that they're now again below TRA. In some sense, I think this is more consistent with the intent of this legislation going back in history than the alternative.
Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, I don't see, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't see that the payments would stop at any point.
Representative Thiessen.
Madam Chair, I think that's correct under the language I see here. Yeah.
They're
but
not
maybe we
stop
can
for
clarify
anybody,
this.
Are they?
Yes.
Mr. Stoffel.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Wergen, I think if you find it quickly here on page 56, I believe it is, and maybe staff could correct me if I'm wrong, but on line 56.12, section or letter B, the paragraph B indicates that the aid would be terminated if our assets exceed our liabilities, basically if we become overfunded.
Right.
I think that's what that is indicating. It refers to the aid in subdivision 3A. Which is where these aid amounts are. So I believe that indicates that when our assets exceed our actuarial accrued liabilities, then the aid would be terminated or redirected again.
I'll renew my motion, I guess.
All in favor of the adoption of 25A, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion is adopted.
I think there's another non-military amendment over there. did Ursula get up?
The administration aid.
Yeah.
You need to go with Lisa. She's going to have all the copies.
Members, what will be passed out momentarily, because of the lateness of the hour and because the bill was introduced, we have the language of the amortization aid bill that was dealt with by the commission on April 8th, I believe. And although the request from Representative Thiessen was to draft it as an amendment, it was just physically impossible to get the Xeroxing done and do that. So what you have is the language, and I believe you can incorporate with a verbal motion the contents of the bill or what portions or changes in it that you see fit.
Yes. And members, this is, we talked about this at the last, Madam Chair, at the last commission meeting. This is the redirection of aid to St. Paul Teachers of Retirement, the Minneapolis Police and Fire, the volunteer firefighters, and the City of Duluth. If you recall that discussion we had. And I think where we left it last time actually was changing the percentages. So I guess just to get things in order, I'd move as an amendment the House File 3744 and then incorporate on line 2.33, change the 25 to 20 in two places.
Representative, I actually have a document that I think will do what
you
want
to
do.
Okay. So I'll move 3744 and then move this amendment. And what the amendment would do would go to the 20-20-40 split, so 40% of the aid would be going to the Volunteer Fire Relief Associations and 20 each to St. Paul Teachers, to the Minneapolis Police and Fire, and to the City of Duluth. And again, just to refresh people's recollections, the gist of this is that there is this aid, again, stream of aid that is has been going to pay for incorporating different fire department relief associations into the state police and fire, and some of those are expiring, and so it's capturing those revenue streams and kind of reallocating it. And so I guess first, Madam Chair, I'd move the 3744-11A amendment just to get it in the order. Okay, first of all, I need to amend the 11A amendment. Oops. Insert on line 1.4, insert a period after 20 and delete the rest of that line and delete line 1.5. And I'd incorporate that into my motion, and then I'd move the 11A amendment. And Madam Chair, I'd also incorporate into the amendment on line 1.6, delete police and firefighters relief associations and.
And delete.
Can we have those again now?
Yes.
All
I'm on line 1.4 on the 11A amendment, I'm deleting everything after 20, the number 20, and deleting 1.5, mm-hmm. everything. And then on 1.6, I'm deleting the words delete police and firefighters relief associations and. So that line would read page 3, line 2, delete 25. And that would then do, I think, what I described before.
Madam Chair, I think that gets us to where we were at mm-hmm. in the discussion when we left this off.
Right. So if we could just put that amendment on and then talk about the bill.
All in favor of the 11A amendment as amended, orally amended, say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Thiessen.
Well, I think we had a discussion last time, so I'd stand for questions or further discussion.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to thank Representative Thiessen for his amendment and being willing to work with us, and I would very much be in support of passing this.
So then the volunteer fire departments get 40%. Any discussion, Senator Wergen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not speaking in opposition to the amendment, just asking a question from Representative Thiessen, if I could.
Yeah.
we kind of talked about these figures on the fly the last time and then laid the bill aside, and I will frankly admit I didn't expect it to come back up. Did you do any subsequent investigation as to whether these figures really made sense and whether they would make the appropriate funds, put them into better condition, or are we still just doing this on the fly because they were the numbers that were thrown out?
Senator, Representative Heason.
Madam Chair, I think they will help the funds because they're all in a deficit, but beyond that, no. I mean, I think you're properly characterizing the choice of numbers.
But, Senator, we're going to... That's one of the reasons I held the bill from the last time to this time so long, so that if there were concerns about various parts of the bill, that people could come forth and express them either individually with the authors or with me or with the staff. And there wasn't a whole lot of people drumming their knocking on the door kind of thing. So I think people are pretty comfortable. Ms. Olson, or Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I would say just, you know, I wouldn't want people to think that this is totally an ad hoc decision, because it seems to me that that some special consideration was given to Duluth and working with the members of the committee or the commission that had some concerns there because of specific issues and needs that it has. But beyond that, as you said, everyone, I mean, this is really kind of a form of local government aid, and everyone can use the help. And so beyond that, it tries to give some balance to the state geographically, and I think that that's a very defensible and kind of fair way of doing things. So.
And, Madam Chair, I would agree with that, and I was only responding to the... I think we did have a discussion at the last meeting about a lot of these issues in terms of balancing across the state, and we know each of these are underfunded. I just was more responding to kind of interim work on that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair,
Senator Larson.
The one thing that it did allow us to do is have a lot more discussions about the situation in Duluth and making sure that the dollars that they're headed there are headed to the right place. And so that discussion has occurred since the bill has been laid aside, and I think we've found the right balance.
Is Duluth going to be able to receive money under the 2010? Ms. Vanek? Isn't there something about the date?
Madam Chair,
when this becomes available and when the other bill cuts off?
Madam Chair and members, Duluth has one additional payment to come to us, roughly $3.8 million, that they have to make by January 31st of 2009. And you're talking about part of the money they already get for that payment then going to them later. After their payments are completed. So it doesn't help them in 2009.
Right. But what will happen in 2010 with the new language?
Madam Chair and members, as I understand the bill that you've just crafted, they will continue to receive additional money from this pool. They will no longer have an additional amortization payment on the merged plans, but it's certainly, I would expect, would help them with their overall police and fire costs, since... I don't know what they're receiving currently.
And it can go in that fund.
I would defer to Mr. Martin for that question. I'm not sure where it's going once it goes to Duluth.
We want to make sure it goes to the right spot, Representative Heason.
I agree. The language is to go to the city of Duluth to pay for the cost of their police and firefighter relief associations. And so...
Ms. Maddox.
Madam Chair, they have one payment left. That's an annual. That's an extra payment toward the amortization of those two relief association accounts, and then they're just have regular ongoing payroll contributions into the police and fire fund, just like every other community has for their police and fire members. So, I didn't really understand how this was all being crafted, but I'm sure it's going to help them because they're going to be short for making the additional payments. They don't expect that they'll receive sufficient aid to reimburse the $3.8 million payment they made this January, nor will they receive sufficient aid in 09 to reimburse them for the payment they have to make by January 31st. But beyond that, I'm not sure how the money is intended to be used by the city. I defer to Mr. Martin on that.
Members,
if there's any dissonance in the language, it has to do with the fact that the relief associations involved here consolidated with PERA, police and fire, Duluth Police in 1987, early 1990s for the fire. And their costs for those relief associations will be gone after January of 2009. This is legislation that doesn't kick in until 2010. So that's the dissonance. The entities don't exist and the costs don't exist when this is going to become effective. And you're specifying that that's what it's attributable to or to be paid for. If you look at the last page of the bill, the last page of the packet, which is on lines 3.1 through 3.3, I think you can make this less dissonant if you take out on page 3, line 2, the words relief associations. So then it's just costs associated with our police and fire. It becomes more generic and it's not so specific, and then there's at least less dissonance.
I will move that amendment. So on line 3.2, take out the words relief associations. And do we want to? They still have pension contributions they have to make, however. I mean, so could we say police and firefighter? Costs associated with police and firefighter pensions, and that would allow them to help set the. So it's not just any police and fire, but.
Thiessen moves delete relief associations and insert pensions. All in favor, say aye.
Madam Chair, I have a question.
I'm sorry.
Are we talking about on just line 3.2, or would the same thing be applicable on line 3.3?
Madam Chair, Senator, there are volunteer fire plans, and they have ongoing costs. So it's only 3.2. It's in this case the only recipient who would have no pension costs at the time that this new aid entitlement kicks in is Duluth. And so I think that's the only one you have to remedy.
All in favor of the Thiessen Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is adopted.
I'd renew my motion on the amendment, the
3744
amendment.
To include 3744 as amended to 3082.
That's it.
Further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Military buyback. Statewide fire.
Members, the Dash 24A amendment was provided to me earlier today by Mr. Zickman and representatives of the legislation to create a statewide volunteer fire plan. And I think it would be best to have them explain this is somewhat substantive or potentially substantive.
Mr. Zickman.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Niall Zickman representing the volunteer fire groups. We met with PERA yesterday. I'll let Ms. Vanek comment on the changes they'd suggested to get it to work for them. As we worked with the through the Department of Public Safety and the Governor's Office on the appointment processes and trying to respect the comments that Representative Kahn had indicated, and when we made the changes, they had indicated to us it'd take 3 to 4 months minimum to get the appointments made. And as we wanted to get this next draft plan ready for you as we come to the next session, we thought it might be more expedient to allow the association presidents, the league presidents, township presidents to appoint this initial advisory council. It'd be more expedient. We kept the language. We inserted volunteer firefighter to make sure it's all clear, you know, on who's doing that. So the language where you see appointed by the president by those respective associations is just an attempt to keep the process going in an expedient manner so we can get those people appointed, get that advisory council moving, to allow that draft plan to come back to you for implementation next year. And I'll let Ms. Vanek speak to the other changes that their AG had recommended.
Ms. Vanek.
Madam Chair, members, Mary Vanek, PERA. Mr. Zickman did address our Board of Trustees. The idea of us working with an advisory committee to or board to come up with this plan, and our board did support that. They did direct us to work with our legal advisor from the Office of the Attorney General to clean up the language to ensure that we were comfortable with how it was to be structured, and we did that earlier. And he suggested that the role that PERA play is that the director provides advice and administrative support to the board in the creation of the actual plan document that will be presented as legislation next year. We clarified that there is no compensation to the board members by the state or PERA. We wanted that clear, so the amendment on line 1.24 addresses, or 1.22 through 1.24 addresses that fact that we will not be required to provide any kind of expense reimbursements from PERA or from the state to these folks. And just really kind of puts it in order to say that this is a working board that will be dispelled of, that will expire once the plan is together and the legislature has created an ongoing advisory board to work with the PERA Board of Trustees and the overall administration of the plan once you've adopted the actual plan next session.
Any questions? I move adoption of 24A. Mr. Nick Zickman, did you pass this by Auditor Otto?
I have not had a chance to speak with Auditor Otto. I was just shared her interest, and they'll certainly be an integral part of these discussions.
Ms. Vanek?
Madam Chair, Auditor Otto is a member of our Board of Trustees, so she was participated in that discussion, and I've had further discussions with her.
Thank you. All in favor of adoption of 24A, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Mr. Fleming?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commission members. I'm Morgan Fleming. I'm here on behalf of SEIU Middle Management, and I visited with Teamster Representative Bob Johnson and the MAPE folks and the Executive Directors of PRA and MSRS, and Murph have seen this language. It's an amendment on Article 15 of your omnibus bill. It has one section, creates a new clause D. This is the membership dues for annuitants in a voluntary organization representing annuitants. And the new clause D would require the labor organization be limited to deal with annuitants who are members of the exclusive bargaining unit. And we like that language. And further, the new clause E adds a proportional share in the cost. That's what the amendment does.
Ms. Blau? And there's the need for this language because?
Because the bargaining units that I mentioned would like to be the people that would contact their used-to-be members who are now annuitants, that they were the bargaining unit for the retirement.
Ms. Blau?
Madam Chair, members of the Commission, I'm Julie Blau, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. I've not seen this amendment. In the little understanding I have here, as it was explained, it would change fundamentally what we had worked on and proposed and worked with the Commission to refine during their meeting.
So you would be opposed to this amendment?
Madam Chair, yes, as I understand it, because I think it changes fundamentally the structure of what we proposed.
We'll set this amendment aside for a few minutes, and you and Mr. Morgan can talk about it. Mr. Fleming.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. All of us received a letter from somebody. So, Mr. Voracek, who wanted to buy back his military service. And he just missed the timeline, and it went by. And so Representative Teesum had this amendment prepared, which would allow a military person to buy back. And is this at any time? No? Forever?
Yeah.
Forever, and so we would never have to...
Madam Chair, it's a permanent part of the code. If you look on page 1, line 26, it does extend it for 5 years. So you would look at it again, presumably around 2013, when it would expire otherwise. We sunsetted these provisions previously, and it may be good to sunset it again if the same logic still applies.
And they have to pay the full actuarial value, and there's no cost to the program. And there's no objection, or is there objection? Mr. Bergstrom, Ms. Vanek?
It only applies to the ERA.
It only applies to the ERA. Yeah. So it's okay. I'll move adoption of BA04 as Representative Teesum had it prepared. Any further discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. You don't have any of this, Ed Hammond? Oh, yeah, the MSRS ones. There's two MSRS ones, and Mr. Bergstrom has to leave before 5, so good thing.
Who wants a raise?
Ms. Bergstrom, 22A.
Madam Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, and I'm the director of the Minnesota State Retirement System. This amendment, I believe, is pretty technical. The amendment adds to the State Board of Investment staff to protection from losses or suit by the participant if they choose bad investments and lose money. So under the draft that we have, if somebody chooses the wrong investments and they lose money, MSRS staff is protected, the board is protected, but it left out the State Board of Investment. This would add them back in.
I'll move the 22A amendment, Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? All in favor of the Betzel's amendment to adopt 22A, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Yeah, that's another. There's a long one.
Okay.
Oh, you've got.
Okay.
Mr. Bergstrom, 19A.
Madam Chair, again, I think this is mostly technical. I do apologize for bringing this forward at a late time, but since the last pension commission, the state auditor called our office, and there was just some confusion regarding who was eligible for our health care savings plan. We administer the health care savings plan for all city, county, state employees, and when we drafted it, the membership just said employees. That doesn't necessarily cover local elected officials or volunteer firefighters. So what we're trying to do is just clarify who is eligible for this plan. We patterned it after the Minnesota Deferred Compensation Plan as well. The operative language that we wanted to add really was on page 2, lines 212 through 2.23. And what it does is it says anybody, for the most part, anybody who is part of a public pension plan is also eligible to participate in our health care savings plan. And that was the substantive part when we were working with Mr. Burek on this. He recommended some other good changes to our law just to clarify the board's responsibility and my responsibility and to clean things up as well. So those are included in this amendment, and those, I think, are purely technical.
Any discussion?
I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel moves adoption of Amendment 19A. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you.
Dana Wheeler, Dana Wheeler.
He's right here.
Yes, he emailed us this morning, or I read the email this morning. He's the executive director of MGEC, which is Minnesota Governmental Engineers Council, and has a. Wants to be included in something we did last year. And he has no lobbyists. And so he just caught on to it yesterday. And that's why he's coming before us tonight. Mr. Wheeler.
Hi. I'm Dana Wheeler, Executive Director for the Minnesota Government Engineers Council. We represent one of the bargaining units representing your state employees. There are about just under 1,000 members for MGEC who are engineers, land surveyors, engineering specialists, and so forth. And we have a small staff, as you mentioned, 1.5 full-time equivalents. We rely on something called the Pepsi Commission and opportunities to speak with the other lobbyists to help us keep informed of the various bills that have passed. And it, recently through staff discussions, our other staff person became aware of the amendment a year ago to allow the staff of the Minnesota Middle Management Association to participate in the MSRS retirement plan. And we were hoping to do the same thing. again, I apologize for such late notice. It was only because we didn't hear through our normal circles that this change had been made that we acted upon it today as soon as we learned that it had happened in the past and that MSRS would not be in opposition to this. I don't know if you have the language which was forwarded to you in my proposal and summary and current law, or if you'd like me to pass that out.
If you have it, you could pass it out, because I didn't make copies. And Mr. Bergstrom, would you come down, please? And Mr. Martin and Mr. Burt do not have the language, so they need the copies.
The proposal would be an amendment to Minnesota Statute 352.01, Subdivision 2A, adding the clause number 18. You currently have 17, which provided this benefit for MMA. This would add clause 18, allowing employees of the Minnesota Government Engineers Council and to whom Section 352.029 does not apply. That last section means they're not employees who are currently on leave from their state employment.
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, we are comfortable with the amendment. You did the same thing for Middle Management Association. My understanding, it's for prospective service only, so there wouldn't be any buybacks, and we're comfortable with it.
Is that your understanding, Mr. Wheeler, that there would not be any buybacks, and this is prospective?
That's correct.
And would you like to change the word in the highlighted part, who to whom, on the second sentence or second line?
That would be fine.
Okay. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Just so I can get clear. Mr. Wheeler, now, when were you alerted to this? You said recently. When were you alerted to this?
We became aware that this provision had been applied to MMA the end of last week. I believe it was Friday. To confirm that, I called Mr. Bergstrom at MSRS. We exchanged voicemails. We reached each other today, and he was able to confirm for me that this rumor had, in fact, passed. He pointed me to the statute where I could become familiar with it, and within the half hour, I sent three committee members, including yourself, this information.
Okay. Well, and Madam Chair, and you know, I will. I mean, Mr. Wheeler, tomorrow morning would have been too late. You understand that. And Madam Chair, as we're wrapping up this bill, I am not going to be very sympathetic to anybody who comes to me after this bill leaves this committee and starts going through the process that has just discovered something, wants to be added to the bill at some point. People have known the legislature has been meeting. And I think that, you know, you may have a small group, but people have to check those things out, pay attention to what's going on in the world, and not expect the legislature to just drop everything just because we have to be in session and accommodate them. I'll be willing to go along with this, Mr. Wheeler, but I'm just serving notice that if people are just discovering issues and finding out about them, we'll see you next year. But I'll move the amendment as modified, Madam Chair.
And I strongly echo your words. And when they come to my door, I will not be sympathetic either after today. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. And don't you go out and say that you told that you got in under the last light and that she'll do it for anybody. Thank you for coming, Mr. Wheeler.
Come back,
have they? They're still out. We have any more minutes? So what do you want to do?
Can we recess for about 5 minutes?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk to them and them? Or what are we recessing for?
I want to talk to them.
Okay.